May it please the Court. When an incorporated subsidiary participating in a multi-employer plan is spun off outside of its old control group and then subsequently withdraws, it's the new owner and not the old owner that bears all of the withdrawal liability. This is a clear rule under this Court's precedent in Sherwin-Williams and every other authority to consider the matter. So in order to avoid this well-established principle, in this case, Central States Fund contends that a different result is required because of an internal corporate reorganization occurring within the old control group prior to the spinoff. And this is wrong. ERISA treats the entire control group as the employer. That's in 29 U.S.C. 1301b1. And therefore, the movement of assets and operations within a control group internally has no effect on creating or calculating withdrawal liability under MEPA.
But, you know, I guess one of the issues that concerns me about your position is that as the district court envisioned this, the district court really tried to pick apart the transactions and see where not only the corporate reorganizations were going, but what was happening to the contribution histories as these various organizations moved along. Because what we're talking about, as I understand it, is what's the numerator in this fraction for withdrawal liability. And there is a moment when the old subs get merged into Centra, and when they do, their contribution histories move with them along into Centra. And then, you know, as you say, at some point later on, the new subs go, and I think the whole contribution history stays within this one control group. These companies are still all affiliated for a long time. And what concerns me about your position is it seems like, under your view, it would be very easy for a company to peel off its contribution history and essentially make it go away by simply creating a new subsidiary that you underfund, make sure that new subsidiary declares bankruptcy, and then, boom, there's nobody to pay these unfunded liabilities into the pension plan.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, there's a separate section, Section 4212C, which deals with transactions with the principal purpose to evade or avoid withdrawal liability. And that issue was not reached by the district court, and therefore is not presented on this appeal.
The district court has that footnote saying it's here, but I'm not going to talk about it.
That's correct, Your Honor. The arbitrator ruled in our favor on that issue. That's a factual finding. It's subject to clear error review, but the district court never reached it. And in our view, that's how the statute deals with your hypothetical scenario. The statute distinguishes between asset transfers and sale of incorporated subsidiaries. Asset transfers are governed by 4204 with their sold to an unrelated party, and that has separate provisions.
Isn't that the whole issue here? The question is whether the contribution history goes with the assets or it doesn't go with the assets. Seems to me.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're contending that it does, I think.
Well, Your Honor, 4204 governs
the merger with the U.S. truck. That was the assets were injected or whatever you want to call it into these new subsidiaries.
Well, Your Honor.
And the question is, does that carry the contribution history with it? I think.
Well, when I was talking about asset sales, I was talking about asset sales to unrelated parties, which is what 4204 governs. In our view, asset sales or transfers within a control group are simply immaterial. Those kind of corporate reorganizations happen.
Why is this within a control group?
Well, it was because the old subs, the holding company Centra, and later the new subs, were all part of one control group. And therefore, they had the same ownership. And therefore, in our view, the movement of those operations within the control group is simply not something that ERISA gives any significance to.
Well, even and at before, that point, wouldn't you agree at that point, Centra would have been fully liable for withdrawal income if the moment of withdrawal had come?
Exactly, Your Honor. Centra was fully liable for any potential withdrawal before any of these transactions occurred, because it was part of the control group, it was
and
the
after.
Parent company, and it was fully liable after.
And it's still, I mean, you know, since unless you answer Judge Cuddy's question differently, I don't see why it isn't still.
Your Honor, the liability was held by the entire control group. The idea that the potential liability would be assigned to a particular piece of the control group as a result of an internal organization is something that, as far as we know, no court has ever held. It's an inventive theory designed by the Central States Fund to get around the clear ruling that when you spin off an incorporated subsidiary, that the withdrawal liability, subsequent withdrawal liability, is borne by the new owner, not the old owner.
You didn't spin anything off here. You just sold or transferred assets.
No, Your Honor. It was the assets were placed within an incorporated subsidiary, U.S. Trust, which then left the control group. And that's exactly the kind of transaction.
But you're assuming all of the contribution history moved with those assets, which was a rather small subset of the assets, the old subsidiaries, the old companies, old Central Cartage and old Central Transport. You're assuming somehow the contribution history, you know, you have $1 million and then you give $1 of assets to U.S. Truck, and somehow the contribution history that attached the assets representing $1 million moved to the one.
This talk about contribution histories having an existence prior to withdrawal is a rather metaphysical concept. Withdrawal liability does not accrue over time. It arises at the time of withdrawal. And with a couple of statutory exceptions, 4204 and 4212, the withdrawal liability is imposed on the employer at the time of withdrawal and not a prior employer. The contribution histories are calculated at the time of withdrawal. That's what this court said in Nighthawk Express. And so,
but who's the entity that you're looking at? I mean, yes, the contribution histories are calculated at the time of withdrawal, but the entire structure of the statute is designed to make sure that somebody stands behind the unvested pension rights of people from the old employer.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the way the statute does it is it provides that withdrawal liability falls on the employer at the time of withdrawal and not a prior employer, with two statutory exceptions. One is where there's an asset sale in 4204 and secondary liability has been assumed by the selling employer. And the second is where a transaction has been set aside under 4212C as being undertaken for a principal purpose to evade or avoid withdrawal liability. What the district court and the fund have done here is they've created a third non-statutory exception in a situation where there was an internal corporate reorganization that caused the spun-off entity or the corporate subsidiary that sold to somehow unfairly not carry enough assets to pay off potential withdrawal liability.
If that isn't understood as part of the statutory structure, then it seems to me you might as well repeal the whole unvested contribution language of the statute. Everyone would do what you've done.
Your Honor, it's been clear since it was adopted that spinning off a subsidiary transfers withdrawal liability to the purchaser.
If, as Judge Cuddy, he said, that's what we should understand that you did.
I understand, Your Honor.
Right.
And if that's done in order to evade or avoid withdrawal liability, then the fund can set it aside if it meets that standard. What the fund is trying to do here now is, without meeting the heavy burden of 4212C, without showing the arbitrator was clearly erroneous in finding as a fact that they had not met that burden, or that they were even entitled to raise it because it was not raised timely, they're trying to argue for the same result. And so as a result, what they're trying to do is get two bites at the apple, to set it aside under this kind of non-statutory provision as an alternative, because it's easier for them than meeting their burden under 4212C. I understand the court's concern about abusive transactions to avoid withdrawal liability. But the way the statute addresses that is in 4212C, not by creating some kind of very artificial test of internal corporate reorganizations that would somehow cause withdrawal liability to be caught up in one piece of a company rather than another.
Now, one of the arguments the fund makes in the alternative is if we were to agree with you that the district court's decision should be reversed, we should still demand for consideration of this theory.
Yes, Your Honor, we agree with that. In other words, because that alternative ground is not reached by the district court, then we believe they're entitled to argue before the district court, if this court remands, that the arbitrator's finding of fact there was clearly erroneous. And that's in our view, the statutory burden they bear, and that the district court was wrong to excuse them from that by creating this kind of inventive theory, which we don't believe finds support in the language of the statute. And if there are any more questions, I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, that's fine. Mr. Condon.
May it please the Court, I am James Condon for the Central States Pension Fund. Mr. Willard indicated that the issue here is whether, when a subsidiary is spun off, it takes its pension contribution history with it. Well, that, as so stated, yes, that's what happens in a stock sale. In a stock sale, a subsidiary that is sold takes its pension contribution history out of the control group. But it's not so easy as Mr. Willard suggested. The subsidiary whose stock was sold here were new subsidiaries, which were really formed at about the time that the old subsidiaries merged into Centra, the parent, that we think took the old subsidiary's contribution history.
Now, does it make a difference if we regard this the way the arbitrator did as some kind of holistic transaction that just was shuffling the cards simultaneously to create those new subsidiaries, or whether we pick it apart the way the district court did and say, well, first there's the merger of the old ones into Centra, and then sometime later or whatever, there's the next step?
I do think you have to look at the transactions in steps the way the arbitrator did. It's almost as if Centra is arguing that they invented some whole new form of transaction unknown to the common law or any statute. It's like a hyphenated German word, a merger, asset transfer, stock, drop down, break.
They don't actually even hyphenate in German. They just put it all together without without breaks.
But it, in fact, you have to analyze it step by step. And it doesn't, and at one point we concede, of course, the arbitrator said that the asset transfer was simultaneous with the merger. It doesn't really make any difference whether one was first or one was second or one was simultaneous, because if they transferred the assets first, as Judge Cudahy noted and as had been noted in the Nighthawk decision, under MEPA, an asset transfer is just like an asset transfer in any other context. It only transfers assets, not liabilities. You can't prejudice the creditors of a company just because you've shuffled the deck internally.
Now, I want to get one thing rather clear. The parties, as far as I can tell from this, do not have any dispute about the moment, the withdrawal event, right? You know, at what moment was withdrawal?
That is correct.
Okay. That's when the DI, the Detroit International Bridge entity, left.
Correct. That was in November 1997. That was so found by the arbitrator.
Right.
And originally, there was a dispute concerning it. It was ruled on by the arbitrator to be November 1997, and all parties accept that.
Okay. So the only question we're really dealing with is, as of that moment, was it possible as a matter of law, and indeed was the fund entitled to go to Centra for the withdrawal liability, or was the fund limited to going to these new entities?
As of November 1997, were we...
Well, who could you... I mean, there's some withdrawal liability that is triggered by the withdrawal at that moment. And the question is, whose was it and who had to pay?
It was, in our view, it was Sentra's by virtue of
somebody else's who don't happen to have any money, so that you're going to collect anything.
Correct. The old subsidiaries were basically, as the CEO of Sentra described them to his board, the new subsidiaries were denuded of assets.
So the old subsidiaries get folded into Sentra, and it's your feeling that even though some assets left Sentra thereafter, the liability stayed with Sentra and was there at the moment of withdrawal, so then that was who would have to pay.
That is correct. And that just follows. And in this regard, of course, MEPA, just the statute, just follows the common law rule, and there's no reason to think that it wouldn't. As this court noted in the Sherwin-Williams decision, these rules under 4218 and so forth basically incorporate common law doctrines. And, you know, we've been talking about this.
When you say common law doctrines, do you really mean, in fact, you know, just sort of ordinary principles of corporate organization?
Yes.
That's statutory.
Merger, successorship in that sense, the effect of asset and stock sales. But, you know, Mr. Willard mentioned that contribution history, at least pre-withdrawal, is a sort of metaphysical concept and doesn't exist anywhere. That's not true under Nighthawk. Nighthawk expressly refers to contribution history pre-withdrawal as a liability. But more important, under the statute, what this contribution history is under 4211 of ERISA, it's called the required contributions. Well, the required contributions to a multi-employer plan are, of course, contractually required obligations. And those obligations can only be incurred by an individual corporation, not a control group as a whole. It's true if there's an event of withdrawal, the contribution history of the individual corporations who have a contractual obligation for the contribution history have incurred that over time.
But in other words, you're saying contribution history, I mean, this is what I've always kind of understood. I mean, there's a company, it's got a contract to provide, you know, pension coverage, there's a certain number of employees, there's a certain amount of contribution, it's got some liability for that. And then there's a future tail out there, which, of course, you're not going to know about until the moment of withdrawal.
Correct. It's effectively a contingent liability, and, of course, there are many cases that say in a merger, the successor to the merger takes all the liability, including contingent liability. And it's interesting in this case, of course, we have in evidence all the merger documents. We also have in evidence Sentra's 1995 tax return, which expressly describes this merger transaction and says that Sentra, the parent corporation, took possession of all assets and assumed all liabilities of the old subs. And that's at our the appendix to our brief at page 85.
Do you agree that the possibility of some future withdrawal isn't a current thing? It is more like a contingent liability. Should a withdrawal event ever happen, then it will ripen into something.
That is correct, Judge Wood. We believe that's the only way the statute can work. Otherwise, you end up not fully allocating these required contributions to the constituent corporations in the control group that incurred them over time. That represents, each of those contributions represents a pension obligation that corresponds to a pension obligation that the pension fund has. Under the statute, the responsibility for the unfunded portion has to be fully allocated to all those constituent corporations that historically participated. The mechanism that the statute uses to do that is this required contribution. If you consign it to some metaphysical oblivion, as Mr. Willard would have it, the statute doesn't work. People are able to shove off onto other employers. I'm sorry, Judge.
Well, what I'd like you to address for a minute is why you think Mr. Willard is not correct that if there's a theory in this case at all, it's a 4212C theory as opposed to a more direct theory.
Right. Well, 4212C is, of course, our alternative theory.
Right.
In this case. And they're not.
Why isn't that your only theory?
Well, for one, For one thing, it's because we believe this is the correct way the statute works. We think our primary theory represents the ordinary operation of the statute as Congress intended. And in the alternative, we say, well, if we're wrong about that, then we think the intent or a principal purpose of these transactions was to evade or avoid withdrawal liability. These theories, they're not cumulative. They're admittedly inconsistent and alternative in that sense. And in fact, it's interesting, we feel so strongly about a primary theory, it actually offered us less recovery. It's a $14.7 million theory, but because of the slight differences in the control, in the contribution history used and the deviation in the data withdrawal, we would get about $5.5 million under the alternative evade or avoid theory. So, I mean, I just offer that as reflective of how strongly we felt about a primary theory. Mr. Willard has also indicated that the control group rule requires sort of a disregard of corporate identities. We don't think that's true for the reason I indicated with regard to what contribution history really means. It really means the required contributions of individual business entities. But in addition, the structure of 4218, which deals with changes in corporate and changes in business form or corporate reorganization, has a closing provision which says, for purposes of this part, a successor or parent corporation or other entity resulting from one of these corporate changes shall be considered the original employer. Well, you wouldn't need, obviously that is dealing with internal reshufflings of a control group or a corporate structure. You wouldn't need a rule like that if it was a no-holds-barred situation with regard to internal corporate structuring. It specifically contemplates that there would be successors. It doesn't say who the successor would be. And for that purpose, we think you have to look to ordinary principles of corporate law and successorship, which would require Centra to be the successor by merger. With regard to the impact implication of 4204, the asset sale provision to this case, we believe it does inform the court, it should inform the court's interpretation of the statute, because it is a separate statute that deals with how to address asset sales under the whole MEPA structure. And in Centra was not able to comply in any way with the requirements of 4204, and it's applicable by its terms only to asset sales between unrelated entities, not related entities. And so we think this means that Congress intended to closely police, really to disallow any kind of asset sale exemption between related parties, which is essentially what Centra is trying to accomplish in this case. So we think that 4204 is very much applicable in this case. I'll mention briefly the impact of 4218, the corporate reorganization provision that I mentioned previously. We don't think that's applicable because, as the court held in Sherwin-Williams, it's only applicable where there's a withdrawal due to the cessation of existence of a participating employer. There was no withdrawal in this case as a result of any of these reorganization transactions.
Well, that's why I mentioned what I did before. I mean, this case is not about the withdrawal so much as it's about who do you look to and how do you calculate how much has to be paid once this agreed moment of withdrawal happens.
The allocation of the contribution history. And so 4218 is inapplicable for that reason. We also believe it is inapplicable because there was no division in this case. The only corporate reorganization under the statute that Centra has been able to argue for under 4218 is a division. We think the case law is very clear in saying that a division doesn't cover the type of asset transfer that we're talking about here.
What do you think division does mean?
It refers to, for example, it's a stock transaction, and typically it would refer to a spinoff of stock to the owners of an existing corporation, a spinoff or split up of a corporation, which didn't happen here. As I've indicated, our evade or avoid position is an alternative and a backup theory. We don't think it's necessary for the court to reach it, as the district court also believed.
And you agree that that is something that would require a remand. It's not the kind of thing we could decide right now.
I believe that's correct. I believe that if for any reason the court believes it's necessary to reach that evade or avoid alternative, which we don't believe is the case, we believe a remand would be prudent because the district court had superior briefing, frankly, on that alternative theory. And so I would ask that the court simply remand Judge Hart's decision. And unless the court has any further questions at this time.
You're not really asking only for us to remand, I assume. You probably want us to affirm.
I'm sorry, I said remand. I'm not asking for a remand. Only in the alternative, I'm asking for a remand. I appreciate the correction. If no further questions, I'll sit down.
Fine. Anything further, Mr. Willard?
First, on the issue of remand, we agree that would be the normal course of action if the court ruled in our favor. But if the court decided for reasons of judicial economy to address the issue yourself, because the district court in that case is also sitting as effectively an appellate court, we would certainly ask for the ability to submit supplemental briefs, because I think both sides assumed that this court, that issue is not before this court. I would like to... It seems to me that the questions this court asked of Mr. Condon reveal the kind of tortured logic that is behind the fund's position here and the artificial nature of its efforts to avoid its burden under 4212C. Which our position is fundamentally inconsistent with the approach that the statute takes to an organization that's a single control group that has other parts. 29 U.S.C. 1301b1 says, and I'll just quote the relevant provisions of the sentence, for purposes of this title, all employees of trades or businesses, whether or not incorporated, which are under common control, shall be treated as employed by a single employer, and all such trades and businesses as a single employer. So that means the control group, for all purposes of this statute, is one employer. And therefore, the convoluted internal transactions that occurred here didn't change the fact that the control group was the employer, not the old subs, not the holding company, not the new subs, not U.S. Truck prior to the spinoff, but it was the whole group was the employer. And we're not aware of any situation where contribution histories and employer status get separated for purposes of calculating withdrawal liability, except for the two statutory exceptions I mentioned before. One where there's secondary liability of a former owner in an asset sale transaction, and the second is where a transaction is disregarded for purposes of the statute under the evade or avoid standard. And it's only because the fund is uncomfortable with trying to meet its burden under evade or avoid that it's come up with this highly artificial theory of why it can parse out what occurred here in a way that would somehow change the normal rule of MEPA, which is withdrawal liability falls on the person who's the employer at the time of withdrawal. And that rule may not always be fair in some cases, but MEPA is a very complicated statute that makes a lot of lines be drawn. And sometimes when withdrawal liability is assessed, it's more than maybe it really should be, to be fair, or maybe it's less than it really should be, to be fair. But the statute is a completely reticulated mechanism for determining this. And The court shouldn't be creating new extra statutory rules to change the outcome.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel, all counsel, I should say. We will take the case under advisement.